So, as everybody knows, so what holography says is that the theory on a brain is equivalent to string theory in the back reactive geometry. Yeah, and there's all kinds of details. You have to go to the large n limit and pass through the near horizon limit and whatever, but this is the idea. So twisted holography is just the same thing. But for the topological string, instead of for the physical string. So what I want to do today is explain what the topological string is. So I'm mostly going to take a space-time perspective, but I'll start at the beginning. I'll give you a few different ways to think about it. Suppose X is a Calabi-Yau threefold. We can consider the 2,2 sigma model, we target x, and this has two topological twists. So one way to think of, to understand the top, what the topological string is, equal to, this is kind of just a slogan, the twisted 2,2 sigma model coupled to 2D topological gravity. So since there is two twists of the sigma model, there are correspondingly two topological strings, the A and the B model. And saying coupled topological gravity is a little cryptic. Roughly, it means we integrate over the moduli of the world sheet. Okay, so this is one traditional description of the topological string, but for our purposes, it's not the most useful. Okay, one important point to make about it, though, is so the A model this is all about world sheet instantons. Whereas the B model there's no worksheet so that means if I have a map, this satisfies the B model equations. that means f is constant. Okay. So why is this useful? So we know when we do ordinary string theory, if I tried to build a quantum field theory out of string theory by saying the space of fields is the Hilbert space of the string on a circle, then, well, that's not really a quantum field theory. It's not quite local. And it's not local because your particles interact through string world sheets, which don't live at points. This is much better. So if we were to do string field theory here, we get a local quantum field theory, or really gravitational theory on X. So this is called Cotier-Spencer. Sometimes PCOP theory after the authors who invented it. So what I'm going to be aiming at today is kind of to give a description of this. But you notice that this just doesn't work with the A model. The A model does not give a local quantum field theory.
Some real questions, starting from the more mundane. Is it important to know what twisted and 2,2 mean here? Or
no, I'm going to focus on the space-time, and I'm going to give a description of this. But I wanted to give some background for people who are familiar with other topics, just to orient it.
Fair enough. Yeah. And the second question would be then, if there are no instant times, is it easy to see that satisfying the equation of motion implies f is constant?
Well, a world sheet instanton is a solution of the equation of motion that is not constant.
It's a solution
of motion. Okay, rapid two-cycle or something.
Okay, fair enough. Yes. Okay.
But there are still quantum fluctuations around the constant.
Exactly. So that's why it gives you an interesting quantum field theory. And you know, the usual string theory picture is that the integral over the moduli of the Riemann surface, which is something, you know, 3G minus three-dimensional complex integral, is supposed to match the Schwinger parameters in your quantum field theory. So another important description, in fact, more important description for us, again, this is just to orient everybody about how topological strings fit into the world they might already know. These are live inside, they're a subsector of the physical string. So more precisely, on X cross R4, so the B model, topological string amplitudes, are going to be equal to the type 2B BPS amplitudes in a certain background. So I think this was how people originally discovered the topological strings in the 90s. As a nice subsector of the physical string. And of course, this works for the A model type 2A. There's two ways to describe it, to describe this correspondence. So,
what is BPS amplitude? It's some amplitude which has like restricted supersymmetry, or
some amplitude. Well, I'll be more precise in a second, but it's an amplitude for a state which respects space-time supersymmetry, not the world sheet supersymmetry. So 90s language, we turn on a gravity photon background. So I don't expect you to know what a gravity photon is. It's just some particular U1 gauge field in the n equals 2 supergravity multiplet. And doing this brings us to the topological string as long as we look at supersymmetric states. So modern perspective, we turn on an omega background. It's the same thing, but a better language. So what does this mean? We introduce some background field. So that a certain supercharge, space-time supercharge, Q squares rotation. Angular coordinates. Okay, so this is, you know, the picture. This is what Nekrasov does when he wants to regularize the instanton partition function, for instance. And okay, what's the point? Once I do this, you can look. You know, because normally when I have a supercharge, I would like to take its cohomology. But this doesn't really work because it doesn't square to zero. It squares to rotation. But if you like algebraic topology, you'll know, well, if I want to take the equivariant cohomology, I look for a differential whose square is a rotation. It'd be the circle equivariant cohomology. And to do it, we first take rotationally invariant things, then take the Q cohomology. So then the statement is the B model is equal to Q cohomology of the S1 invariant states. So the spectrum of the B model is obtained from the spectrum of 2B in this way. And the amplitudes of the B model are also just obtained by taking the amplitudes of 2B on these states. Okay. So this is a really useful perspective, because now we can think about how various dualities relate to the topological string and so forth. Okay. Questions?
Yeah. Just turning an omega background or gravity background to form the space-time geometries?
Yeah, there's like, I don't remember the details. You can, simplest way to figure it out is you go to 2A, and in 2A there's a lift to M theory where you just have a circle, you have a certain circle bundle where this, as you go around the circle, you generate this rotation. And that generates downstairs a certain metric and one form, so on. So it's that background. And you have to trace it through the duality.
What is R2 epsilon and minus epsilon?
So the epsilon means it's just a plane with some, I mean, because we're, this is, for our perspective, the precise metric on this plane doesn't matter. And the epsilon means it's rotating with one way or the other way, plus epsilon or minus.
This may be a very basic question, but why does turning a background field feels like it changes the Suzy algebra?
Yeah, so let's understand that from M theory. Say, let's say x11 or something, and there's a relation. I want to make this periodic. So I'm going to write down the relation for these three coordinates. So this means as I go around this circle, when I come back to where I started, I've rotated in these two planes. And now let's think about upstairs, we have supersymmetries which square to translations. So here, translations up here, they become combinations of translation and rotation. So if I have a supersymmetry whose square is translation along this direction, once I go down to 2A, it becomes something involving rotation here.
Maybe one last, no, because I actually don't know what an Omega background is, but maybe it's not important. I just want to ask, like, what's the main takeaways one should have given if one lacks the context? Just that there's a charge that squares to zero, sorry, it squares to rotation, and taking a Kronecker homology, you have a, that would be the main takeaway.
Yeah, okay, good point. I think I didn't say a very important point. In general, omega backgrounds like this, we localize to the fixed points of rotation. So here, for example, let 10d to b localizes to the 6d b model. For example, if I had a d3 which wraps c times 4 to epsilon, where c is a curve, complex curve. Again, this omega background localizes to 2D CFT on C. Okay, so this is the beam, one way of saying the beam Restalli et al. Chiral algebra. So they have a chiral algebra for a system with n equals 2 supersymmetry. This is one way. Realize it. Okay, any other questions? So we would like to understand just be a razor. Oh, there's. So now,
hi, Kevin.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have a question about. I mean, when I think of twist, I either think of past acute cohomology or turn on some background, like a rigid supergravity background, or a combination of the two. Can you just tell me where that picture fits in here, if at all?
Sorry, could you say that again?
Well, usually when I think of what's meant by twist, I either mean past acute cohomology, which I guess I see in the picture you've discussed, or possibly turn on some like rigid supergravity background, then, you know, twist so that you have like an actual nilpotent Q on a on a curved manifold. Can you tell me how that fits in here with the topological gravity and the omega deformation? And
yes, okay, so normally you might think, okay, if I have the theory on a D3 brain, like N equals 4 super Yang Mills, you might say, if I want to twist it, I want to do something so that I actually have a supercharge on my manifold. So I would turn on a background gauge field for the Ohr symmetry, and I would relate that to the Levi-Civita connection on my 4 manifold. So I assume that's what you mean?
Yes, exactly.
But that's implicit here, because the gauge field for the Ohr symmetry, that tells me about the normal bundle. So as long as my manifold here is x times or 4, as long as this global manifold admits enough covariant constant spinners to do this procedure, so which you need x to be Calabi-Yau, then I'm already doing what you said on my brains. That make sense?
I think so. So in some sense, you're using the x direction, which, like, if I was interested in doing it on R4 or something like that, I'm using the X direction to get access to some covariantly constant things?
Yeah, exactly. Or rather, you know, if you said, I want to study a D3 brain on some complicated 4-manifold M and twist it, the twisting procedure means that in type 2B, you're not on M times R4, you're maybe on the cotangent bundle of M or something like that.
Okay.
So,
right. Thank
so that
you.
Geometry is implicit here. OK, so let's try and figure out what the spectrum of the B model is. So type 2B supergravity, it contains, of course, the graviton, which contains, on shell, a Ricci flat metric on X. So it turns out that BPS states of type 2B supergravity contain metrics on X of SU3 holonomy. Well, basically, BPS means you have a supercharge. And for that, you need to have a covariant constant spinner. And having SU3 holonomy, the group SU3 preserves a spinner, so therefore it's have a covariant constant spinner. And let's consider deformations. So, well, of course, SU3 holonomy implies that it's Kähler. So that the metric is determined by omega and I, where omega is a two-form in X, and I is a complex structure. OK, so we're going to expect that whatever lives in the B model is going to have fields which look like these two tensors, roughly. But an important part of this construction is when I take Q cohomology, I'm not only asking for states that are Q closed, I'm getting rid of those which are in the image of Q. And it turns out that for the B twist, the Kähler form is exact. So therefore, you expect that the fields of the space-time theory thus include the forming the complex structure on X So, but importantly, we don't want any deformation. X was Calabi-Yau, which means it has comes with the holomorphic volume form. So I want to preserve the holomorphic volume form. Okay, so I want to spend a few minutes explaining what kind of tensor it is that will change the complex structure. It's called a Beltrami differential, and it's some kind of very old theory.
Can you explain it in the first two sentences? Because I think I didn't understand.
Okay, so if I look at the on-shell states of type 2 supergravity, it's going to include a bunch of stuff, but one of the things it includes is a graviton. So it's a Ricci flat metric on my manifold. So I'm in this story, we're only really going to be interested in how the metric changes along x. So we conclude that whatever fields we have in the B model are going to be related to Ricci flat metrics on x. The second line is a bit stronger because the fields we find in the B model, we don't want. Part of this Q cohomology procedure is I'm not allowed to do an arbitrary fluctuation of x which breaks supersymmetry. That's not going to be an on-shell state in the twisted theory. So if you ask, what's the condition we need to preserve for supersymmetry? It's this stronger condition that the holonomy is SU3. So then there's this fact which I'm black boxing that the Kähler. So we can break up deformations of the SU3 into two pieces, and the Kähler part turns out not to matter. It turns out to disappear in cohomology.
What is the Kähler part, sorry?
What's that?
What's the Kähler part?
What's this two form, omega, which is.
Is it a part of the metric?
It's part of the metric. So the formula is like, I have a complex structure, and the metric So both tensors are here. There's some relationship between them, which ensures that this is a symmetric tensor. Yeah.
So for the A model, is it the opposite?
Yes, the A model is the opposite. But yeah.
When we say the Kähler two form is exact, we mean with respect to Q, right?
With respect to Q, yes, exactly. So like. If you were to like very carefully study the type 2B supergravity multiplet, we can express the however many components of the metric. Some of them are related to here, and some of them are related to here. And the ones which are related to omega, there's going to be some gravitino which cancels with it in cohomology. Like, it's possible to actually do this by hand, but it's a huge pain.
And naively, if I read that, if omega were exact, I would set the metric to zero as in Q cohomology. again, it's very nice.
No, I have an initial metric.
Yeah.
G naught, and then I'm deforming both things here to look at first order fluctuations of the metric. So first order fluctuation will be the Kähler form times the deformation, or deformation times the undeformed one here. So we're saying like those deformations which come from deforming here, they don't matter.
Okay.
You also said that R3 deformation of the complex structure on X will not be on shell in the theory. Is there some requirement, like some equation of motion or something that?
Yeah. So I'm getting it. So there's this, but if I just try to deform this tensor randomly, that's not going to be on shell. So I'll get to that in a sec.
But there are also, like in the full 2B series, there are also other fluctuations.
There are also other fluctuations, yes.
Yeah, and like on shell, they are not essential, but like on a quantum level.
Absolutely, yeah. If you try to just quantize this piece of it, you would run into an anomaly immediately.
Okay.
But they turn out to be pretty simple in the B model, so we'll get to that later. How do we deform the complex structure? So we have this operator I from tx to tx. Let's view it as going from t star, actually, just by doing this adjoint. So then we get, by passing to sections, we get some linear operator on the space of one forms. And I'm going to tensor with C. So if we do this, we can define omega 1, 0. And omega 0, 1 and this is like say the plus I eigenspace. This is the minus I eigenspace. So we've done something very simple. We've just taken our one forms and broken them up into two pieces. So the question is, we would like this data to determine a complex manifold. So to do that, we need to figure out, the key thing one does in a complex manifold is look at holomorphic functions. So we need to figure out how to change the equation that something is holomorphic. And this data is enough to determine that. So suppose we have an infinitesimal deformation of I. Then in coordinates, of the d bar operator, which goes from omega 0, 0 this starts as. This deforms to. It deforms by adding on this term. I'm not sure I explained this very carefully. It kind of follows from the definition of what's the debar operator. I just take D and then I project onto the 0,1 component. And I've defined the 0,1 component for I where these are just certain components of I. And I has some symmetries, which means that these are the same data. OK, this was a little fast. The thing to, I think you can just take away is deforming the complex structure means in coordinates I'm deforming this guy, but this is, it should be a bar, by adding on this term. And I'm using this to change what it means to be holomorphic.
What's the other part of I?
What's that?
Does the other part of I do
anything? It's complex conjugate because I is a real matrix of rank 2n and square minus 1. This is complex to the other components of the complex conjugate.
The deformation is a that thing we are adding is like a regular piece. Or can it be something non-singular at some point on space-time?
It can't have any singularities. Yes, I want this tensor mu just to be like a smooth field on space-time. I mean, I suppose. Okay, take that back. If you wanted to introduce source and back react something, then mu would have singularities. But for now. It's just a smooth field.
Yeah. Just to make sure I understand. So this instrument has some deformation. It's really just a tangent in the 1,0 direction because you're just changing the 0,1 kind of slightly. To
yes.
Therefore, why you write mu I bar j dot lz.
Yes. You can think about it as to give a complex structure is the same as to give the subspace omega 1,0, and I'm deforming that, and the way you deform it is to give a map to its quotient. So omega 1,0 to omega 0,1, and that's what that is.
Just to elaborate on that point, because, because I struggled to parse it. So it's related to, this complex structure that maps from tangent to tangent, that's squares to 1, somehow that's in one-to-one correspondence with a double bow operator.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The way, because how
the eigenspaces, it defines eigenspaces.
It defines the Durama operator we always have.
And you can project. Okay, the projection would define a double operator, perfect.
Exactly. Yeah, and there's a formula for the projection, of course. So you can figure out the double as like projection times d.
Fair enough.
And that's.
And so deforming this this field is equivalent to now deforming the double operator, which we define as adding this piece. By the way, it's got. The mu thing has a dz. Should it be ddz or ddz bar?
It's ddz because otherwise.
You're staying within the same.
Exactly. I want to look at the equation where it's killed by dolbo plus this. And if it was dvdz bar, I'm not changing anything.
Yeah, that's OK. Fair enough. Yeah.
Sorry, it's always gonna be like integrable.
That's no. I mean, you want these operators to commute with each other. So that's a constraint on you, which will be the equations in motion. So holomorphic functions in the deformed geometry satisfy, I'm going to call it, say, d bar u equals 0, f equals 0, i.e. df dz bar I bar plus u I bar j they satisfy this PDE. So if we have a nice complex manifold, we would like to have, you know, if it's a dimension n, 3 in this case, I would like to have 3 independent holomorphic functions. Now, that's not obvious that I can find 3 independent solutions to this equation. So as Bunjin mentioned, we should remember our undergraduate ODEs and the Frobenius integrability theorem that says, if I have an equation like this, you know, I can only find enough solutions, like a sufficient condition for finding enough solutions is that these operators commute with each other. Say 3 independent solutions or equivalently, that the deformed Dolbo operator is squares to 0. So this gives a PDE from U, and that PDE will be the equations of motion. What was that?
Does it come from the supergravity equation?
It comes from a combination of the supergravity equations in motion and the condition that it's BPS. Because if I had, you know, if I have a covariant constant spinner, that cuts the Hall limit down to SC3. And that means, in particular, it's a complex manifold. I can find 3 independent holomorphic functions, and that implies this holds. In fact, the astonishing thing is the converse is true. If I have a compact Calabi-Yau and I deform it in this way, then you can also find the metric by Yau's theorem, or the Oban-Yau theorem.
Sorry for taking us
all
the way back, but I think I'm missing why we need to tensor with C there.
A real matrix may not have big values.
Right. Because it squares minus 1. So because it squares minus 1, the eigenvalues also have to square to minus 1. But you know, the real reason is the things we like to write down in on a complex manifold, like dz and dz bar, those have complex coefficients, like dz is like dx plus idy. That's that I we need to put it. Where were we? Okay, so we're going to build an action which will have this as its equation of motion, and that'll be the action for the B model, the Cotterill-Spencer action. But there's one more constraint. We need the form geometry to be Clavier. That is, it must have a holomorphic volume form. So let's check, let's figure out the constraint for this by working in coordinates. We say in coordinate zi, zi plus, say, epsilon wi, I'm going to deform it, the holomorphic coordinates in the deformed complex structure. I'm going to get this right. So I know the equation. I'm just forgetting the derivation. So the constraint this is a divergence constraint. It's a divergence u equals zero. And this implies that there is a holomorphic volume form in the deformed complex structure. Sorry, there's a formula for it, but it's escaping my mind temporarily. Basically, if omega is the original form, then it looks like this. Is a new one, and then, okay. The equation is that a del of this is zero. Sorry, that was a little vague. So maybe we can skip over this detail and just impose this constraint. I realize I'm a little tired, I'm not getting everything right.
But this constraint doesn't include the volume form, yes? It doesn't depend on it.
It depends on the volume form up to a scale.
Oh, okay.
Just in the same way, if you have a vector field, its divergence depends on the volume form up to a scale.
Okay.
Like a constant scale, not a
Epsilon is a dimension full parameter.
What's it?
Epsilon has dimensions.
And that, no. Well, firstly, it's hard to talk about dimensions in working on a curved manifold, but no, I wouldn't say epsilon has dimensions.
But I thought it was the part, like, how we were doing the rotation.
Sorry. I used epsilon for two different things.
Oh.
Sorry about that. Okay, so what do PC of V do? So PC of V, what they do is they look at fields U, satisfying that constraint. So this constraint is not part of the equations of motion, and they build a Lagrangian whose equations of motion enforce integrability of. So if you give me 5 minutes, I could write down the Lagrangian, or I could do it next time. What preferences? Might as well write it down. Okay, it's a bit weird. It's the only thing. I'm going to write it down in index notation. I think that will be the most widely accessible. If I have eta, which is in 0, 1 form x, the exterior square of the tangent bundle, so eta looks like and it's anti-symmetric in J and K. We define it, the divergence of eta to be so if mu is such that div mu equals 0. Well, you can check that the square of this operator is 0 for the usual reason that the square of the Durham operator is 0, because partials commute. So if I have a mu as before whose divergence is 0, then we can find then there exists an eta equals mu, and we call this
Globally,
by degeneration posture Durham spectral sequences. Oh, hold on. You're right, locally. Yeah, you were right the first time. So the slightly weird looking action is Can I response or action? Is integral u Okay, so this thing here with the d bars and the epsilons, that's just d bar. This is wedging things together. But there's this funny thing where I take its inverse and use the epsilon tensor to contract it, plus maybe, I think it's like a factor of a third, u j bar m u k bar n. Okay, so this is the action. And you can write it in coordinates. So you can write it in an index-free notation in a slightly slicker way, but it's the same expression. And in fact, the equations of motion implies integrability. In the sense we discussed before, that there's enough holomorphic functions. So to see that, you vary mu here, I get this thing with the inverse, the divergence, and two mu's. I hit it with the divergence, and I bring the divergence over here. And that gives me the two terms of the equation.
But divergence should, like inverse divergence should not be uniquely defined. There should be some freedom, right?
Yes.
You can add something which is divergence.
Yes.
Plus.
Exactly, and that should be zero.
Yeah, so how it comes?
Personally, my perspective on this action is well, there's a couple of ways to think about it. If you like BV, you can think about this as a degenerate BV theory, meaning that there's a Poisson bracket, but it's not symplectic. And then if you take that perspective, it's actually totally fine, and you don't need to do any inverses. It's just there's a divergence appearing in the BV bracket. In more pedestrian level, if you try to figure out what the propagator is for this theory and do perturbation theory, that's also totally fine. Because the propagator is given by the inverse of this. So that will be the usual propagator for the D-bar operator. It's like the Bogner-Martinelli kernel, hit with divergence. So the propagator is a very reasonable thing, and perturbation theory makes total sense. So even though this looks bad, it's actually OK.
So we call on a computational level, propagator is well defined, so we can compute perturbation theory.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, concretely, the propagator is like del D-bar inverse, which is like del bar star class inverse. Mm-hmm. So that's totally fine.
That's propagator for whom? Sorry, for the divergence, the minus one.
Yeah.
Should the equations of motion at that point be expressed more in terms of the eta thing here, or well, it made me think something like
yeah.
A and F. And, like,
that's a really good point. If I had like. If this was like a BF theory and there was two different species of mu field, then I would do that. But actually, it's worth mentioning that the exact same problem happens in type 2B string theory. because if you look at the phi-form field of type 2B string theory, it's supposed to be like a dynamical field where the equation that it's closed is not part of the equation's in motion. Because it's supposed to be like the field strength of something. And there's a kinetic term which looks just like this. But you also, like for the other Raman-Raman fields of type 2 string theory, of type 2B, because, you know, they kind of pair 3-form and 7-form, you pick one and it all works. You have a 3-form and a 7-form, I say, okay, my 3-form is D of a 2-form, then I have my 7-form. That's all fine. But for the 5-form, it doesn't work. So this is descended from that issue.
So far, we think about this only on a classical level. This is just initial condition.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. If you wanted to think about it at a quantum level, it's kind of challenging because it's non-normalizable by power counting. So.
Mm-hmm. Also, just to summarize for myself, so we had to deform a double operator that led to that mu. Somehow, there were some equations for that mu to exist that had to satisfy the commutator one, the commutator equation.
That just got erased, yeah. That commutator equation is what I'm calling the integrability.
Perfect, yes. Yeah. So that we can find that. Because otherwise, the mu is only defined locally. We want it to be defined globally. That's an integrability question.
No, the integrability thing is you know, I work locally. Can I find, I write down my, I've changed what it means to be holomorphic by adding this new term.
Yeah.
And can I find enough solutions to that equation? That system of three equations.
Okay. So it's not a topological problem. It's a
yeah, exactly. It's if I just write down some random I, then I change my what it means to be holomorphic. You can presumably find one holomorphic function, but you probably can't find three.
Okay. Maybe my dad. I don't know why we would need three, but for it, we can. Well, in any case, just to not like there, then there's another constraint because of the Calabi-Yau. It needs to be remain Calabi-Yau that imposes the divergence less than the mu.
Mm-hmm.
And those two can be encapsulated in this action.
Well, so we're not treating them the same way. So divergenceness I'm imposing as a constraint in the space of fields. I'm only integrating over those divergence-free mu's in the path integral. And then the other equation is the equation of motion.
Okay.
And again, you should think about it like in other contexts. I want to do Maxwell theory. I'm integrating over the space of closed two forms, if you'd like.
Yeah, exactly. That. Yeah, I thought that's why I thought using that analogy. I thought, okay, let's express everything in terms of A to impose a constraint implicitly. But here we keep both. Like in Maxwell, I don't keep F. I express everything in terms of A. So I thought here I would express everything in terms of eta, and get the.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So exactly. But yeah, in Maxwell theory, you could do it in two ways, and get the two dual descriptions of abelian gauge theory. See, what I said about the phi form wasn't quite right, but this. So suppose I had, you know, in the phi form of type 2B, I have a self-dual closed field. That was the issue. So there's an obstruction to like taking a primitive and playing this game.
Okay.
Once you deform the complex structure, the constraint the divergence of mu is zero is to preserve the holomorphy of the volume form.
Yes.
The volume form itself.
Well, it's kind of the same thing, really. I thought this through more carefully. Oh yeah, of course. I'm being really dumb. I said something really dumb. It's just the constraint that divergence mu is zero. You are exactly right. If I take dz1, dz2, dz3, and I look at d bar mu of this, that's going to be. I'm going to think about how mu. acts on this. But you should think of the action as given by lead derivative. So it's going to have three terms. There'll be something like dz bar I d u I bar 1 dz 2 dz 3 plus the other terms. And that must be 0. So I think what's going to happen is that that's we're going to differentiate with respect to z1. And I'm ready for the other team. I think that's what happens.
In the earlier discussion, you said that the B model does not have any instantons.
Yes.
And that, that corresponds to the fact that the solutions to the equations of motion are constant fields.
The world shape equation of motion. The space-time equation of motion is different.
This axiom that we wrote that corresponds to the deform theory, like how do we relate these to the like the supergravity fields or
right.
to the sigma model that we
So the equation that I was calling integrability, like how that? Yeah, so so that's a consequence of being a BPS state. I always did. If you have a BPS, if you have a BPS state in type 2B, it's on the x. It's going to be a manifold of SU3 holonomy. And there's some standard thing in differential geometry that if you have SU3 holonomy, then you have a complex structure. In fact, it's not hard because it's just because SU3 preserves the complex structure locally on C3, so we get a complex structure in every tangent bundle. And the fact that so that because it's SU3 holonomy, this is a covariant constant one, and that implies the integrability.
I cannot conceptualize for myself, so. Like, how does this condition of state to be BPS looks from the point of view of world shape theory? So we have super like target space supercharge generator, and we want like what vertex operator to be annihilated by it. Or
yes, but you're absolutely right. It's extremely subtle, because the it's much easier to see from type 2B supergravity, because you type down type supergravity, of course it's a hideous mess. But in principle, you have formulae for how the supercharges act, and you can just check it. But from the world sheet, the generators of space-time supersymmetry live in the Ramon-Ramon sector. So they're kind of tricky to understand. And so what you're supposed to do is take that state in the Ramon sector and take some state maybe in the ENS sector and kind of wind it around your contour integral of one around the other. And it should be preserved.
Which other fields apply?
Yeah, so there's two other fields, and I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure they come from two of the Ramon-Ramon forms, but I'll have to remind myself.
Does the space of deformations of the complex structure on X have any kind of nice properties since X is Calabi-L? Like, does it secretly remember the symplectic form used to be there or something as well? Or does that give it any nice extra things for your space of fields?
I mean, the space of deformations of complex structures in my Calabi-L has lots of beautiful properties. It's not related to the Kähler form. But there's this very nice way of encoding the genus zero string theory data by saying, this is due to Givental, that this space of deformations is a Lagrangian. You know, I take a deformation, and because I'm Calabiau, my homomorphic volume form carries along. I take its cohomology class. So you get a map from the moduli of deformations to H3. And that map embeds the moduli of deformations as a Lagrangian cone. So that's the nice thing.